Welcome to Geek Ketchup. I'm Kyle Eckert alongside Chris Heck. We're two lifelong friends with a passion for all things geek. Whether it's gaming, movies, television, wrestling, comics, whatever. If it's nerdy, there's a good chance we're into it. You are listening to Chapter 15 of Season 1. It's our penultimate chapter as our season finale on June 23rd approaches. Today, we're taking it back to the old school because we're two fools who are so cool. Not really, but we are going old school to review the NES and SNES classics Ghosts and Goblins and Super Ghouls and Ghosts. Before we get started here, Chris and I would like to take a moment to say thank you for listening to this chapter and thank you to everyone that's been listening. There's a lot going on in the world right now and we appreciate you choosing to spend your time with us. Hopefully everyone is staying safe and healthy. Also, we hope that in this short time you're hanging out with us, it's a nice break from the high stress we are all experiencing. Usually this is the part where I ask you to spread the word about Geek Ketchup on social media and to stay saucy. Instead, we'll ask that you spread the word on using common sense, love, listening, and caring for one another. And to quote Uncle Iroh, it is important to draw wisdom from many different places. If you take it from only one place, it becomes rigid and stale.
Today, Kyle and I are bringing you a retro game spotlight where we take a look at two absolute video game classics from the 1980s and 90s that neither of us have played in more than 20 years. Ghosts and Goblins is a run-and-gun type platformer that originally debuted in arcades on September 19, 1985 and has been an infamous part of video game history ever since. Created by Takuro Fujiwara, the same guy who brought us the Mega Man franchise, and published by Capcom, Ghosts and Goblins has sold over 4.4 million units over the past 35 years and has spawned more than a dozen sequels and spin-off titles. It is also revered by many as one of the hardest video games ever released.
One of the most popular sequels in the series was Super Ghosts and Ghouls, which was developed for and released on the Super Nintendo on November 28, 1991. In 1997, Super Ghouls and Ghosts was ranked as the 22nd best console game of all time by Electronic Gaming Monthly. But despite having enhanced graphics and gameplay, it was a much lower commercial success than its predecessor, with just over 1 million copies sold. With plots inspired by the lore of King Arthur and demonology, the game lets you take control of Sir Arthur, a knight in the service of Princess Prinprin. And throughout the game series, Arthur embarks on a grand and perilous journey to save the princess from the evil demons after they snatch her away at the start.
We spent some time over the last few weeks playing both of these games in the NES and SNES emulators available on the Nintendo Switch and have broken both down using our Geek Ketchup rating system. This consists of five categories: gameplay, graphics and sounds, technical performance, story, and sauciness. So as we move through each category, Kyle and I are going to discuss our experiences and thoughts for both of these brutal classics. And first up, we're going to start with gameplay.
So yeah, I mean, gameplay straight out the gate on the NES one, this is easily one of the hardest games I've ever played, like bar none on console, whether it's NES, SNES, Genesis, PlayStation 1, 2, 3, 4, Xbox, this game is so hard.
I have to agree, and I absolutely love hard games, so this was something that I really respected as we got back into it. And one of the reasons why we did this when we were talking about it was because of the mythos that is built around these games for how difficult they are, and being that neither of us had really played them in so long, especially not as adults,
yeah,
we wanted to go back and put that to the test. And absolutely, first thing to say out of the gate is these games are extremely difficult.
Extremely. Because you think when you play it as a kid, your skills and hand-eye coordination and everything that goes along with playing video games might not be up to snuff to be able to take on a game like this. So you're just like, oh, well, 20 years later, I'm an adult, I'm experienced, I know how to approach these games, and it might be a little easier for me. No, not easier at all. More difficult than most of the PlayStation games I play these days.
Right. Yeah, games just really aren't made like this anymore. Every now and then you'll see one. I'm thinking Cuphead recently was a run-and-gun type platformer that was modern but also built to be extremely difficult. And that's one reason why I like some of these games, just because of the fact that the industry has gotten away from games that are unbeatable. And as frustrating as it can be, there's also a lot to love there in the challenge, in the skills that it takes. But with the gameplay here, I was really impressed on the NES as far as how well it worked. You know, with all that you've got going on with the different enemy types, different spawns, you know, it moves fast, it keeps you engaged, and you're pretty much just running and gunning nonstop, which was a plus. But I will say that one thing that kind of added to it was that the controls were a little clunky to me. And I know, like, when you're doing things like trying to jump over obstacles or climb ladders, at times you had to be really precise. So beyond just what is going on in the game itself, you really have to be on it with the controls. Otherwise, you're
gonna die. You're going to absolutely die. And you kind of talked about it with some of the controls as far as, like, the jumping mechanics. That's one that definitely sticks out to me, where you have to be precise. Because in this game, unlike a lot of other NES games, you can't control Arthur when he's in the air.
Right.
So once you jump, that's your jump. Like, you don't get to move yourself right or left like you can Mario. It's if you don't time the jump right, the landing is going to be off. And that made it very difficult
right.
to kind of maneuver throughout the level.
Well, and you bring up a good point there, because one thing that we saw in this game was that a lot of the other mechanics or muscle memory that we have developed from playing other similar games of the era, of the style, we found that Ghosts and Goblins kind of bucks some of those trends.
Yeah.
So being able to do things like you said with Mario, where you can move left and right after you jump and you have that freedom to recover from a bad decision or a bad reaction, you don't get any of that in Ghosts and Goblins. So yeah, it was brutal from the standpoint that you had to pretty much run it perfect each time. And that even came in with its own consequences, because, you know, if you accidentally picked up one of the many different weapon types,
yeah,
you would be stuck with that life over life. And some are really good, like the dagger or the lance. Others, like the fireball in the NES game, not so much.
Yeah, not so much. That fireball is a little tough to control. Another thing that makes it really difficult is that there didn't seem to be any timing aspects to it. And that, like, traditionally with a lot of those NES games and old school games, it's just a matter of timing. It's the same level repeated over and over.
Predictable patterns.
Predictable patterns. You could probably run the opening level of Super Mario 3 with a blindfold on.
Right.
After you got so good at it, you would just know the feelings of, like, when to jump, when to move back, this and that. With Ghosts and Goblins, none of that appeared to be working by design.
No.
There was no timing and there were no patterns, like discernible patterns. I mean, sure, you get one or two zombies that always appear in this spot, or like a little ghoul pops up always in this spot. For the most part, like when I first started playing, I was like, wow, this game's really hard. It's going to take me some time to learn the timing and the skills of everything.
Yep.
And then as time went on, I was like, okay, there is no pattern here. I can't guarantee that a zombie's going to pop out of the ground at this exact moment every time. Maybe a raven or a green monster, but some of the other parts were, like, just totally random.
Right, yeah, there were a few that were the same, others that were absolutely spawning at random, moving differently, unpredictably. There were enemies that I had gone through the levels, I don't even know, a dozen plus times in a sitting, and I hadn't seen them do a certain attack. And then on that 13th time, they would drop a projectile attack.
Right.
Or something different. And you're just like, where did that even come from? I've been playing this game for an hour and I've not seen that, you know, while battling these enemy types. So that was almost kind of jarring and maybe a little deflating, because I didn't pick up on that at first either. And so you're thinking, okay, just put the time in, be ready to go, get through the first, you know, couple playthroughs, and you'll start to make some progress. And that aspect alone really is probably what sets up the difficulty to be so hard.
Yeah.
Because when you have such limited controls, such limited items and weapons and things like that, you're really relying on that ability to learn the level, and they take that completely away from you.
Like you said, it makes it so, so hard. And it makes you learn the skills, the limited skills that you have in that game, or like actions you can perform, and you need to perfect them, and you need to be super quick in your head, the decisions you're about to make. And like you said, with the jump, it needs to be the right decision, because if it's the wrong decision, you're dead.
Right.
And another huge difficulty in the game is you only get one life, really. You can get hit one time, and after that, you know, you're gonna die on that second hit. It's like Arthur comes in with his full plate armor on, he gets hit once, he loses the plate armor, goes down to his underwear, and then if he gets hit again, life over, you're starting back at the beginning. Yep. And like all of these different aspects combined, the lack of timing, the limited skills, and there's no give on deaths.
Right.
Like, definitely difficult.
And another contrast to a game like Mario is, at least in Mario, pretty much every level you have multiple opportunities to power yourself back up, grab that mushroom, go from little Mario to big Mario. Now you've got two hits before you die. But in Ghosts and Goblins, you almost never come across new armor. It is there, and you can pick it back up at checkpoints and things like that, but the enemies aren't just dropping those things for you to heal back up and be ready to take on the next challenge.
At one time in hours that we kind of sank into this game, one time did an enemy or a chest box open up an extra set of armor. Like, once.
Yeah.
In, like, hours of gameplay. And it was one of those things where it's like, okay, I've played this level more or less the same way a dozen plus times and didn't get an armor drop. What did I do differently to get an armor drop there?
Yep.
And it's just the sporadicness of the game.
Well, and one thing I learned, too, was that it was one of those situations, right, where after so many times, you finally figure something out. But I had one really good run going, and I got up over 20,000 points, and I realized that that was the threshold for earning extra lives.
Oh, okay.
But you only get like 100 points for every enemy you kill. And so you really had to work pretty hard to get to a point where you're even earning an extra life.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it pretty much hits you in every area. One thing I do have to share is, since we were playing this on the Nintendo Switch online, you know, the emulators, this month they had one of their perks, because if you're not familiar, on the Nintendo Online emulators, they kind of choose different games each month to highlight, and they will give them like a special tag where you'll get different benefits, kind of like cheat codes, where they'll just pick different things that they can give you. Like, I remember, as an example, a couple months back, they had one of the old Zeldas, and when you would start it, you would start with pretty much all of the equipment, so you really had that upper hand and then could go and play the game with the Master Sword and the shield and everything like that. So for Ghosts and Goblins this month, the perk was that you get to skip ahead to level 6, which is the final level,
yeah,
and is by far the most difficult level.
Yeah,
and you get to start out with the dagger, which is one of the better weapons in the game. But when I first went to play it, I didn't realize that that was what the special situation was for this game.
You thought that was level 1?
So I thought it was level 1, and I'm like pretty much taking on just like an onslaught of enemies. And then as soon as you start to climb the first ladders, it's pretty much like a series of bosses from the previous levels. So you get the giant ogre, you get the dragon, and I was just like, oh my god. You know, because I hadn't played it in so long that I didn't have that frame of reference to realize that this was not the beginning of the game.
Right.
So ultimately, when I ran through all the lives they gave me and did not beat the level, I ended up going back to the beginning of the game and realizing it was just as hard at the beginning as it was at the end.
Yeah, there's no give. So, there's no give. You know? Like, and that's just the start to finish. The game just pounds you and doesn't give you any room to make mistakes. Every single aspect of this game is working against you. Like, every single aspect. There's no part of this game, and then when we get to it, really, Super Ghouls and Ghosts as well, that says, oh, well, we're going to give the player this to help them along. No, everything in this environment seems to be working against you. And we kind of touched on a little bit with the fireball. Even your weapons sometimes seem to be working against you with trying to get through the level.
Oh, yeah. I definitely didn't like certain weapons, and sometimes you would get stuck with them because you would be fighting an enemy, they would fall. Of course, we're talking about 8-bit graphics where some things are a little bit blurry. And mind you, this game actually looks pretty good in a lot of ways. I know we'll talk about it here in one of our later categories, but still, anything on 8-bit is a little fuzzy.
Yeah.
You know, some of the colors and textures look very similar. So I know a couple times I was trying to avoid the fireball at all costs, but ended up picking it up. And,
right.
You know, once you died, I mean, you were stuck with it until you had completely lost all your lives and had to start over, you know, or you found another weapon to change it out on. So kind of ruin a run, and you don't almost have to just start over because you wanted to get
Yeah, you just can't have to commit to the fireball. It's the worst. And with the 8-bit graphics, the hitbox, you know, or like the pickup area, I should say, not the hitbox, is so... like precise, but it's hard to tell. It's precise with the coding, I suppose, but like the visual as the player, it's hard to say, like, okay, how close am I to this? How close am I to that? You try to jump over something, and like we said, the jump mechanic is very unique.
Right.
So you miss jump and you're stuck with a fireball until you can find a way. At one point, I'm pretty confident I gave up the fireball, which is meant to be the most powerful weapon, just to go back to the lance, just to go back to the original weapon. Because I felt like it was more consistent.
Yeah, more flexible. You can shoot out more at a time. I think the fireball has a 2-3 limit, you know, as far as how many fireballs you can throw out at one point. Yeah, I think one of the last things that I really want to touch on here as far as gameplay goes with Ghosts and Goblins, because I know that this really surprised me, kind of along the lines of the fact that the enemies would spawn so uniquely and not following a pattern, but... they really did a good job at kind of differing the enemy types.
Yeah.
You know, in a lot of old games, you had enemies that maybe they looked slightly different or they were colored differently, but they were ultimately kind of coming at you in the same way.
Right.
And in this one, pretty much every enemy type brings unique challenges. And I know at one point when we were playing some of the multiplayer on the Switch, we were questioning whether or not the game was... reacting to things that we were doing.
Yeah.
Because certain enemies like the flying gargoyle in level one, you know, you thought you would have him because he looked like he was going to dip down. You'd start shooting and then he would bounce and he would like pump fake you and he would fly back up.
Yeah.
And those are not the types of things you typically see in games from that era.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Like the pattern is the pattern.
Right.
And that's the way it goes. So I'm thinking when you fight like Boomerang Man in Mega Man, Boomerang Man has one set of skills and one pattern. So it's like throws, you jump, move to the right, throw, and then you get like a 3-second period where you can just kind of hammer him. This gargoyle was not. It was like, sometimes I'm going to dip. Sometimes I'm going to fire a fireball. Sometimes I'm going to fire two fireballs. Sometimes I'm going to pump fake it. And it's this, well, how do you react to that? Like in... really just get better at the game is the one response. Like that's how you react to that, Kyle. You get
really lucky.
You get better at the game or you get lucky. And it made for just a really difficult run at it. That gargoyle, and it's like the halfway checkpoint of level one, and it's super difficult.
He's like the mini boss of the level.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you have to beat him to get to the checkpoint, and that even doesn't give you any guarantee that you're going to get through the
right,
level at all.
There's no guarantee there.
So before we get into what we rated Ghosts and Goblins, let's jump over and talk a little bit about Super Ghouls and Ghosts, and then we'll finish up the section with the ratings for both. How's that sound?
Yeah, that sounds good.
All right. So really, I thought the Super Ghouls and Ghosts was pretty cool because it was so similar to Ghosts and Goblins. You know, when you come into those first levels, it feels almost like a remake or what we would call like a remaster today.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where you've got similar enemy types, you've got a similar story, but you've got now 16-bit graphics instead of 8-bit graphics. The Super Nintendo gave them more capabilities. They could handle more assets on screen, better graphics, better colors, you know, the whole nine yards. So that was kind of my first impression, was that it seemed like it was a remaster, but then when you got into it, there were definitely some differences that you learned. I thought one of the coolest things was how they handled the terrain and kind of introduced like dynamic environments that would change. Sometimes you'd be walking and the floor essentially would fall out from under you and you would have to deal with a sunken terrain. Other times it would raise up and you had a little bit more impactful obstacles that you actually had to get over while enemies were coming at you. So what were your first thoughts about Super Ghouls and Ghosts?
My first thought was, okay, this game maybe is a touch easier than the NES version.
At first.
But then once you really start to get into it, you're like, nope, this thing is still super hard. This game's going to kick my ass just the way it's going to go.
Yeah.
But I did enjoy it more. And I, like you said, I really did enjoy the way the ground would move with under you, and kind of like as you're moving along, it would either go up or go down, which would then, of course, change the rock formations that you could jump on top of.
Yep.
And like, once again, going back to that jump mechanic, it would say if the ground moves up or moves down, that's going to, if you're in the midair when it moves, you're kind of screwed.
Yeah.
But it did. It added a very unique feel to it. They added a few extra enemy types as well to go along with the moving ground, like the rolling skeletons that were on fire.
Yep.
That was pretty cool. But to your point, they did almost remake that level one, and that was really cool. It was a nice little like tip of the cap to the original version. And I know that the series went on to do that several times, where like all of the different sequels of Ghosts and Goblins and then Ghouls and Ghosts, they all had that zombie level one. And so it was just a remake over and over, just a tip of the cap back to the original, which was pretty cool.
Yeah, for sure. The thing that came to mind was that I thought that Ghouls and Ghosts really lived up, maybe better than most other games, to the quote-unquote super title.
Yeah.
Because that was a common thing with Nintendo. There was a lot of games that came out on the NES that were then brought over or sequeled on the Super Nintendo, and that was usually one of the big differences, right? Was you got that super...
You got the super, yeah.
...added to the title. But really here, you saw some things, even though that the game itself and the levels felt a little bit similar, you did see them introduce things like the double jump to give you a little bit more agility and freedom. You got additional weapon types. We saw a scythe. There was like an area of effect fire stick, so the fireball got a little bit better.
Right.
There's a bow that would shoot out multiple directions at one time. So they did some of those things. And then they also added in armor upgrades that you can find that would actually change Arthur's performance and help you out a little bit more. So they really did build out on everything. New enemies, new levels.
Which is what you want to see in making the jump from the 1985 NES version to the 1991 SNES version. There was a game in between that came out in 1988, which is due to the name change. But that's what you want to see. Like, if we're going to go to this new console, really take advantage of the 16-bit graphics, really take advantage of, you know, the extra buttons, because they ended up adding four new buttons from the Super Nintendo to the regular Nintendo. And they utilized every piece of that. Like you said, the double jump, extra enemy types, the zombies started to float in the air.
Oh, yeah.
that change was made and block your way. So if like you're just trying to wait up in the air or like stand on top of a rock to kind of like let all the enemies below you do their thing and clear out a space for you to move forward, they'd be like, nope, we're going to have a zombie raise up in the air and they're going to get in your way that way. They added the jumping hyena looking thing.
They took away anything that would allow you to stand still for very long.
Yeah.
You know, as you're moving through the very beginning with just the zombies, you know, you have a few moments where you can stand on top of one of the stones that would pop up that you have to hurdle over. But as you get in and you get past that very brief initial part of the levels, you now are dealing with, like you said, flying enemies, enemies on the ground. The flaming skulls are shooting projectiles at you that will essentially hone in on where you are on the map.
Yeah.
So you've got to, like, that's another part about this game is that you can never stop moving.
You can move back. And maybe that's like a key to the game is to retreat a little bit and set yourself to then move forward. But you can't. If you stop, you die in this game.
Yep.
Something will hit you. It might even be a zombie that comes up from underneath of you, but they will find a way to hit you.
Yeah, there's no reprieve. You pretty much are truly running and gunning from the moment you start each level.
Yeah, absolutely. Another great addition to the NES version, well, I say great, but it's also really annoying, was they started to drop chests, but not every chest was a positive.
That's true.
That Merlin would show up, the little wizard would show up and turn you into a baby. And if that thing turns you into a baby, you're done.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
You might as well just walk into an enemy, because you're not going to survive. And it's like a long time. It turns you into a baby for like 5 to 6 seconds, which doesn't sound like a long time. But in a game like this, when you're slow moving, you can't jump, and you can't fire anything,
you're dead in the water.
You're dead. Yeah, you're dead.
Yeah. I never survived a single time where I got turned into the baby. I did figure out a little bit afterwards that if you're quick enough, you can kill the wizard. before he shoots out the magical ball that turns you into the baby.
Yeah.
But even that became tough. But it was so funny because once you learn that the wizard is a thing and he comes out regularly, then you start questioning whether or not you even want to open the chest, even though you kind of need him.
Yeah.
And so it's just another aspect to tear you down, like make you question all of your choices in this game. So all in all, there really is a lot going on with the gameplay, even though games of that era tended to be fairly simple.
They really took it up and tried to use what they could to make it a dynamic experience for the gamer.
So let's circle back then and talk about how we rated this game based on our 5-point Geek Ketchup scale. So starting with Ghosts and Goblins on the NES, how did you have that rated, Kyle?
I put that at a half star.
Okay.
I gave it a half star. It was a lot of fun. It's a little more difficult for me than, you know, it's not my normal cup of tea. Traditionally, I don't play the Dark Souls type games that kick my ass. I'm more in for a relaxing experience. So this one, I kind of gave it a 0.5 because there are just some certain things that I didn't enjoy. And mainly it was the entire game working against me, which I get is the point. But for me, that takes it down to a half star.
Totally understand. I had it at a half star as well, but for slightly different reasons. So for me, pretty much the half star I gave it was because of how difficult it was because of, you know, how intense the gameplay is. I took it down a half star simply because, and this is just a symptom of the times, right? There's nothing wrong with it per se. It's just how it was back then. But because of the clunkiness of the controls,
yeah.
I felt that there were a number of times where that one directional jump or whatever it may be would just get me killed. And I was struggling with that. So
yeah.
I'm not saying I would have run through the whole game and been a different person if the controls were a little better, but being that it was clunkier, it adds that frustration, kind of took away from it a little bit.
It does. And there's the duck mechanic that doesn't help it either, where you can't duck and then go right into a move. You have to stand up and then move. Little things like that.
Yeah.
Deducted some points.
Yep, for sure. What about Super Ghouls and Ghosts? How did you have that rated?
Super Ghouls and Ghosts, I gave it a full 1 star. I thought it really utilized the SNES upgrades and took all of the stuff that they established in Ghosts and Goblins and just upgraded it. And so I felt like it deserved, it did exactly what a NES to SNES jump should do. So I gave it the full star.
Can't disagree there. I had it at 1 star, very similar sentiments, so I won't be redundant. So that's what we've got there. Half star on Ghosts and Goblins, 1 star on Super Ghouls and Ghosts. Starting out pretty consistent here.
Right? Per usual. I have a feeling we're going to switch it up here as we get into the later things. I was pretty tough on these two games.
All right, so next up here we had the category of graphics and sound. So let's talk about Ghosts and Goblins, as far as that goes. What did you think about the look and the feel and then the sounds it was throwing at us?
The look of Ghosts and Goblins on the NES was pretty solid. You know, for a 1985 NES game, I thought that as far as 8-bit goes, it did look really good. And like you said, with the gameplay, each different enemy type felt unique and looked unique, whether it was a zombie or the flying ghosts with the shields down to the ghouls in the forest. They all had very unique looks and colors, and even the weapon types all looked unique. So as far as graphics, well done, like spot on for 1985. I applaud what they did there.
For sure. That was one of the first things I noticed when we went back to it. Was it's definitely an identifiable NES game. You know, it's got that classic all black, you know, minimal background with everything kind of painted over top of it. But I was really surprised at some of those things that you mentioned, how different each of the characters were designed. There was some textures there differentiating different parts of the terrain as you move between, say, grass and a ledge, the ladders and things like that. It was really simple, but it was just enough to really bring the world to life. And it's presented in a way that just immediately puts you in the heart of a classic kind of fantasy tale.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Another thing is they did a great job at diversifying the attacks from the enemies that might be similar. And what I mean is when the gargoyle fires a fireball at you versus the little green monsters that pop out of the ground. The fireballs actually look slightly different.
Oh, that's a good point.
And it would be super easy for them just kind of like slap on the same, you know, coat of paint for all fireballs. They all look this way. They're all the same color. A fireball is a fireball. But they did a unique job of making one red, one blue, one's a little bigger, one you can duck, one you cannot.
Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't even think about that, but that is a subtle touch
yeah.
that you don't see in some of those older games.
Yeah, so they put a lot of work into the graphics to make it the best they could.
I also thought that they did equally as good with the sounds. You know, you've got that great high energy kind of 80s synth EDM, you know, music behind this that are really keeping you moving, making you bob the head, keeping the energy up, and then some similar, you know, sound effects that I thought really got the point across as far as what you're doing, such as firing your weapon, killing an enemy, things like that. So what do you think about the sound?
I actually kind of disagree with you on the sound.
Oh, really?
I did not enjoy the soundtrack as much as you did, clearly. I thought it was good, not great. You know, when you think of classic NES games, they all have a very memorable soundtrack to them. And for me, that level one, that soundtrack was just not there. I also didn't like the fact that the sound effects, when they came in, they actually cut off the track playing in the background. And while that may be bleed into the next category of technical performance, I'm going to like bring it up here in sound, where I didn't like that. Like the unique sound effects were cool, but I didn't like the fact that it was either one sound or the other sound. There's actually a discernible pause when the sound would happen, and it would throw me out of the rhythm of that back soundtrack playing.
Gotcha. That's a great call out. I don't think I picked up on that at all.
Yeah, it was really one of those things where, honestly, my first playthrough and first time like kind of like thinking about the game, this and that, I wrote down, I was like, oh, there's no soundtrack. This is horrible. And then I went back and played it a few more times. So I was like, oh, no, there is a soundtrack. And what was happening to me is I was like rapid firing the lance so hard in my first couple of playthroughs that the sound effect from the lance was the only thing happening. And I wasn't giving the background music a chance to play.
Gotcha.
So, and I was like, oh, so like my initial note was, oh, the soundtrack's not even there. There is no soundtrack. And then I come to realize, okay, there is one and it's good. But for me, it's not great. Like, it's not something like I'm going to hum.
Sure. You're not taking it with you after you're playing.
I'm not taking it with me. Yeah. Like, you know, when I think about the water level of Mario, like, you say that to somebody and it instantly sticks out in their brain and you can like, yeah, just like that. I didn't get that vibe from Ghosts and Goblins.
Yeah, that's interesting pickup. So what did you think about with Super Ghouls and Ghosts then, as far as that goes? Did you see, because I don't think I noticed in either one, and I thought that the music was fairly similar, but did you notice that the same technical issue happened as far as the music cutting out when you were firing?
Not in the Super Ghouls and Ghosts. I didn't. It all seemed to just progress. It's very similar to gameplay.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, since we jumped over there, what did you think about the graphics on that side then?
So the graphics I liked on Super Ghouls and Ghosts as well. One thing that sticks out to me is that fireball. Is when you throw the fire torch and the way it blows up on the ground. And I thought, you know, it's blue, it creates a path, it looked really good. It was very Contra-esque in both look and sound.
True.
And I enjoyed that. I thought very similar to gameplay from the NES to the SNES jump, graphics and sound did exactly what they should be doing in a console upgrade.
Yeah, they definitely took advantage of the extra 8 bits in the SNES. Brighter colors, richer textures. There was much more going on with pretty much every asset on the screen. Every enemy type looked more detailed, more clear. And then, like you said, the weapons, they introduced things like, because of the torch, it was like an area of effect damage.
Yeah.
So it was like you throw it, it would stop and it would stay there for a second or two and the zombies could walk into it. And so I just really thought that it brought everything much more to life.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, it's exactly my thoughts. I said the soundtrack effects, everything just went up tenfold in the sequel. Even the background was better. Like in the opening cinematic, there was lightning and there was fireworks, and they used the appropriate amount of sound to bring that to the front.
So where did you have these rated? Let's go back to Ghosts and Goblins. How did you have that rated?
Almost identical to my gameplay stuff. I have a half star on Ghosts and Goblins for graphics and sound. And it really was. It was just, it wasn't memorable. And that's what I want out of a retro video game soundtrack. Like, I want it to immediately, like, oh, I want to go Google that and have it be the back the background of my workday. And it just wasn't.
That's fair. I definitely see your points. And now I'm thinking, you know, based on that knowledge, I probably would take this a little bit differently. But coming into it before we talked, I had Ghosts and Goblins at a one star because I was digging it. I was digging the sound. I didn't pick up on the issue that you saw. But one thing that I was kind of looking at it from was looking at that game for what it is and what it for 1985.
Yeah.
Compared to a number of other NES games, it's not like it's light years ahead. But just coming back to it, I actually thought that they did a pretty good job for what it was at that time in video game history. So I gave it the one star.
Yeah, and that's fair. A few other games that came out in 1985, just like as a comparison, that was Super Mario Bros. 1, the original just Soccer, Paperboy, Gradius. Those are all games that came out in 1985, and graphically, it's right on par with those.
Good name drops there.
Yeah, I do what I can.
So then bouncing over to Super Ghouls and Ghosts, I'll start it off because obviously if I gave the NES version a one star, then I don't know how I could possibly not give the Super NES version anything less. So I did give it a full star there as well.
Nice. Yeah, same here. And mainly for the same reasons. It took everything that the NES version did well and upgraded it and then brought the sounds to life as well. So really it was for the NES version, it was a half star based on the graphics. And then for the SNES version, when they went graphics and sound, it got that extra half star for me. So one star for Super Ghouls and Ghosts.
All right. We're pretty lockstep as far as Super goes. We've got a little difference of opinion coming with the NES version, though. So we'll have to see how we wrap up here in a little bit.
Yeah, we'll see. Sooner or later, we're going to get twisted here, and I think we're going to go different ways.
All right. So next up here, category three is technical performance, which in some way seems a little funny to think about on an old school console game. Those cartridge games were pretty steady,
right?
Tend to work pretty well for the most part, but really wanted to look at kind of, you know, things like what the game was doing from a technical standpoint. It's kind of a different discussion than it would be for the consoles of today with how vast all the capabilities are and the graphics and loading and everything like that. We touched on kind of what my biggest item was for these a little bit ago with the inconsistency of enemy spawns. I think that that's the most technically impressive part of this of these games.
It's yeah.
Just how they did that when all other games seem to be completely the opposite. But what did you think here on technical performance, Kyle?
I kind of knocked the technical performance pretty hard because while it was impressive in the way that enemies spawned and their maneuvers and things like that, it also was very glitchy. And I did not appreciate that. Like, if you're going to give me a situation where they can pop up and hit you and vary their attacks, that's fine. But you can't have them glitching off screen or disappearing. Because there was one part in, I think it was the second level, after I got through the first level on the NES version on Ghosts and Goblins, where I was fighting a gargoyle. And I was on the right side of the screen, he was on the left side of the screen, and I was peppering him with the lance. And then he glitched and moved off screen to the left and then reappeared on the right.
Oh, wow.
And hit me from behind. And I was thinking, that's kind of BS in my mind because I can't do that. Like, if you gave me the Pac-Man style, because, like, you know, Pac-Man can move off screen and reappear on the other side. So the enemies can do that, but I can't.
Yeah.
And I felt like that glitch just really pissed me off and totally ruined the experience because I felt like there's so many aspects of this game that are working against you. You can't have the glitches working against you as well.
Now that you say that, I'm trying to think back. I don't know if I saw any real noticeable glitches. If I did, I probably just wrote them off as games of the time.
Games of the time, yeah. I had one instance too. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I think that the worst thing that I saw from the technical standpoint was when it would slow down, and you kept referring to it as bullet time when you were playing multiplayer. But, you know, especially in Super Ghouls and Ghosts, when there would be a lot of assets on the screen, a lot of enemies, a lot of projectiles. You know, you would go to do a double jump and you would see kind of Arthur would just go into really slow motion and you would eventually make it. You know, it didn't necessarily impact whether or not you would make the jump or anything like that, but it just seemed like it was having frame rate issues. I wasn't sure if that was a product of it being on the Switch and it trying to convert to higher picture quality and frame rates, you know, to deal with HDTVs and things like that versus maybe how it ran back on cartridge. Right. I know I wanted to originally play this because I do have Ghosts and Goblins on cartridge for the actual NES, but sadly I learned when I went to play that my NES won't turn on right now, so I kind of cried a little bit inside on that one.
Yeah, it's a sad day.
So I kind of wrote it off more as maybe the just a issue with the port, modern technology, things like that.
That would be fair, because it didn't necessarily work against you when it slowed down, because everything slowed down.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like you were moving slowly, but the enemies were moving quickly. Another glitch that I had with the NES version, though, was, like I talked about it in the gameplay with the hitbox, sometimes things would spawn, or when you'd kill an enemy, and it would drop a piece of armor, which really just gives you points.
Yeah.
And we did a playthrough and we posted up on our YouTube channel, and it actually happens in that playthrough. The armor glitched on a grate.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, I couldn't quite get it. And I did not appreciate that, because it's like, okay, you're giving me an upgrade. It could be a fireball. It could be a dagger, something that I want. But I can't get to it because it's glitched behind a grave.
Right.
And, like, that part, I was a little hard on it, like I said. I'm being really hard and really picky for a game that was made in 1985 and I played a port, but there was just so many factors. I'm like, somewhere this game's got to give you like a little bit of slack, and it just doesn't.
I can understand that, and it does get frustrating, especially when a game is so damn hard. You want anything that'll give you the advantage or the leg up, and it just isn't giving to you. I wouldn't even be surprised if some of that was built in just to make it harder.
Yeah. Well, that's what I mean. Like, some of it's by design. Like, the jump mechanic is clearly by design to make it harder on you.
Yeah.
And so maybe some of these other things are, you know, they're like, oh, well, we can't fix this. And somebody in the back's like, well, screw it. Just makes the game harder.
Right. Now, one thing I did want to touch on, because I didn't have a whole lot of differentiating stuff here as far as technical performance for both of them. They worked kind of in the same way in their own right for each system. Obviously, Super had much more going on, but ultimately, it ran about the same. One thing I did notice was that with Super Ghouls and Ghosts, you got the introduction of gameplay options. So you could, you know, change your layout scheme for your controller. You could give yourself some extra lives to start out with if you wanted to. But there was also multiple difficulties that you could choose from. And that was not something you got to do in Ghosts and Goblins. So that was a very interesting thing to me. You know, we started out playing on normal and it was kicking our asses up and down. And so I was like, all right, well, let's go back, and I wanted to check out the different options. So I don't know if you did this, but I did go and I played a couple runs on beginner difficulty. I played a couple runs on expert difficulty, and then professional
difficulty, yeah.
Which was almost laughable in a game like this. But one thing that I found was it didn't really change the experience very much either way. Even when I lowered the difficulty, felt like I was still playing on normal. And when I went all the way up, the only differentiating things that I could find was that maybe there was a little bit more enemies on the screen, and then sometimes the zombies would run.
Oh, God.
And they would, like, they had a little bit more speed.
Yeah.
But otherwise, you know, it really still felt like playing the same game, and they were all, you know, equally hard. So it was kind of a bummer, because I was like, oh, maybe we can get some reprieve or see some different things based on which difficulty we were on, and I just didn't get that.
Yeah, I didn't do any of that. I think the only thing I did do with Super Ghouls and Ghosts was I gave myself extra lives, but I didn't really play around with the different difficulty types. I figured, oh, I'm going to play it on normal. I'm going to take the game for what it is and go from there. I guess the other thing that I did do, because I was playing on the Switch and playing on the SNES emulator on the Switch, utilize the old L2, R2, or I guess in the case of the Switch, it's the LZ, RZ buttons.
Yeah.
Where you can kind of do the braid maneuver and travel back in time.
See, I didn't mess with that at all.
I did that. That is what I did do instead of messing with the other things, just because I felt like I needed to get through more of the game.
Gotcha.
Like, the game was kicking my ass so hard, I was like, how am I supposed to give this game a fair shake if I can't get past level one? I need to at least see what the other levels look like and experience them so I can, you know, honestly say what I think about this game. And so I did that. Like, there was a couple moments where I would die, and I'm like, I gotta just get past this person just so I can see what the final boss looks like. Because on as far as Super Ghouls and Ghosts, making it to that final boss, because the level is a good bit longer than the NES version, that's what you got to do. Like, you just hit, I'm like, I got to see what this final boss looks like. So I utilize those techniques, and it's one way that actually made the game more enjoyable for me.
That's good. Yeah, maybe I'll have to go back and actually try and use them. It really just didn't come into my mind. I know that they're out there, and I've used them in some of the other games that are on those emulators, but for here, for whatever reason, I think I was just so focused on just like, oh, I'm going to try and get through this, or I'm going to get better at it at some point.
Yeah.
That I wasn't really thinking about some of the other tools that were at our disposal.
And I did it. I took a few honest gameplays. Like, I never did it when I was like, okay, let's take an honest playthrough and see how far I can get. No rewinds. And so I really differentiated between which way I was playing the game. Like, am I playing the game to see the game in its entirety, or am I playing the game to actually try to win? Because, like, if you're playing to win and you use those, that's cheating.
True.
You didn't get those in 1985 or 1991. You just didn't.
That is true. All right, so how did you rate each of these for technical performance?
So for Ghosts and Goblins, NES version, it got a big old goose egg.
Really?
Yeah, big old goose egg. I figured because the glitching problems, the enemies spawning, and the switching on the screens, where my armor things glitched behind a grave, and then to add in, like I said, the sound performance, where it couldn't have music and sound effects at the same time, I was like, there's just too many knocks here, so I had to give it big old zero.
I will be completely transparent here that coming into this, I had it at 1 star, and that was almost completely because I was focused so much on how the game operates from the standpoint of not having discernible patterns.
Right.
Like, that to me really was very impressive for games at this time. So I was kind of focused on that, but as we've been talking and you've brought up some of these other things that I wasn't so focused on, I adjusted my rating down to 0.5 star. Like, I feel like I still give it that prop for what it did there with those other pieces, but you are right. And now that you're pointing out some of the other things, it is a little bit harder to overlook them because they are there.
Yeah. And I think as far as Ghosts and Goblins, under normal circumstances, I think your points would make me want to give it 0.5 star back, but there's so many other things that happen that I just can't do it. The last one I'll point out here is, while I highlighted I like the different look of the fireballs and the ravens and things like that, I did not enjoy the fact that the ravens and the various fireballs all appear to be flying on the same pattern and the same, like, kind of horizontal line, but some of them you can duck and some of them you cannot.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm like, I don't know.
What's the difference?
Like, as a gamer here, you're telling me that the green fireballs are coming at me at eye level and I can duck them, but the blue fireballs I have to jump over because if I try to duck, they hit me and I die.
Like, maybe they're just a little bit wider.
Yeah.
Or something, but it's hard to tell.
It's hard to tell.
Like,
yeah. So if I could, I'd give it 0.25 star back, but we don't do quarter stars here at Geek Ketchup. So it gets a big old goose egg.
Totally fair. What about Super Ghouls and Ghosts?
Super Ghouls and Ghosts, it gets 0.5 star out of me because it did have some overload spots. Like we said, when there was a lot of enemies on the screen, it slowed down into that bullet time. But you can't knock on that too hard because some of that was us also playing together on the Switch.
True. It seemed to happen more when we were playing together connected on the Switch.
Yeah, but it did happen when I played solo. So can't knock on it too hard. It is a 16-bit 1991 game, so I don't want to be too hard on it there, but once again, it upgraded a lot of the other issues.
Yeah,
that I had in Ghosts and Goblins. So Super Ghouls and Ghosts got 0.5 star for just making those improvements. And you're kind of seeing my trend here. Like, if it, you take something and you improve upon it, you're going to get an extra half star out of me.
I'm going to leave my rating at 1 star for Super Ghouls and Ghosts. I definitely agree that the double jump stickiness and then the bullet time that we were seeing, wherever that was coming from, definitely took it down a little bit. But I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it much more than I did Ghosts and Goblins. And probably the last thing I would say, too, that was kind of nice about both of these games, but I think it was even better in Super Ghouls and Ghosts, was that even though you're dying so much, it loads so fast that at least you're kind of like right back into it every time. Like, you are always playing the game.
Yeah.
And so I did appreciate that. You know, if you were dealing with like a modern situation with long load times in between things and resets and the whole nine yards, that sometimes it makes it really hard to even want to play a game.
Yeah.
And if that had been the case here, I don't know if I would have been able to sit down and put in the multiple hours that we did. But I gave it 1 star on that one.
Which is totally fair. Totally fair. But before we wrap up our ratings and reviews, let's take a quick breather for a preview of our Geek Catch-Up Season 1 finale.
June 1981. Portland, Oregon. A night that starts out as innocently as any other. Two friends had arranged to meet up at the movies. But these plans were never kept. With time to kill before the movie, one stops by the arcade. See, a classmate had told him about a new game that had just come out. The idea was to only stay for a moment. But that moment would turn into hours. And what was meant to be a quick trip would change everything. A season finale that will shift all you thought you knew about video games. Geek Ketchup presents Polybius.
Coming back here, we've got two categories left in our review of these games. So next up, Kyle, is story. And, you know, overall, that's probably one of the things that is one of the coolest parts about this game, but also not.
Yeah. I'm with you on that. Yeah, because there's a rich lore there being based off King Arthur and Guinevere and all of the Knights of the Round Table stories that go into it. But for me, you have this great lore, but parts of it feels like you didn't do anything with it.
Right. Well, and that's kind of a trope or issue of older games, right? Is that they didn't have quite the resources to put in cutscenes and dialogue, you know, in every situation. Games like this that were originally built for arcades, you know, definitely weren't in that scenario at that time. It was very much throw your quarter in, get playing. And so, you know, if you didn't have the booklet that came with the game or the internet to research exactly what all was going on and which characters are which, you would almost know nothing about the game. You would just know that you're a knight chasing after a princess. It kind of just looks like medieval Mario at that point, you know?
Yep. Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, and that's kind of like the point of this. At no point in this game do they say you're King, you're Arthur.
Right.
Like, they never, like, and so unless you have the booklet or the back of the box that the cartridge came in, you would have no idea that you're playing as a guy named Arthur and that the princess's name is Prinprin.
Right.
You'd have no way.
Well, and then throwing in the fact that all of the bad guys are demons from, you know, traditional lore. You got Astaroth, you've got Satan comes in at one point. They even bring in, I think, at a later date in one of the sequels, Loki is one of the villains.
Yeah.
So obviously he's a little bit different from demonology, but it's a little scattered. And so you wouldn't necessarily know, like, you just think Gargoyle 1, Red Gargoyle, Blue Gargoyle, you know?
Raven, green monster, worm-looking thing. You would hope that you get a little more. I'm torn here because I'm trying to be lenient, understanding that it is 1985 and you can't add a ton of story into the game and this and that. But at the same time, it's not like we didn't see brief tech scenes in other games during that time, or at least small cutscenes in between levels that highlighted what is happening in the overall story.
Right.
Like, and that's kind of a big knock. as you move from level 1 to level 2, or even the various checkpoints, there's no, like, break in the story.
Right.
In why we're doing this, or, like, what's happening elsewhere. As far as the, as Ghosts and Goblins go, you wake up, like, they don't even address why Arthur is in his underwear and not wearing his armor when the game starts. Like, someone needs to explain that to me.
Getting busy with Prinprin.
Yeah, like, were he and Prinprin just, you know, doing a late night graveyard meetup section? Like, what are they doing? Because they're in a graveyard.
Yeah.
So, like, what is happening there? Like, and then he all of a sudden he puts his armor back on and you're moving and the game is going and it's all fun. But text box and small, even 8-bit cutscenes were not unheard of at the time.
That is true. Yeah, they were rarer, and it became something that got more and more. And we actually saw that in Super Ghouls and Ghosts.
Yes.
Because you got, like, an actual little bit of an intro. It's not much more.
No.
And there wasn't really any text, but you did get a few more scenes. They're developed better. They're more built out, more detailed. You see a little bit of a castle where the princess is taken from versus the graveyard.
Yeah.
Things along those lines. But yeah, you don't really see too much. I know that you didn't see any cutscenes in between level 1 and level 2. And, you know, just to be fully honest, I never made it past level 1. This game kicked my ass for 10 plus hours of playing up and down both of them. And no matter how hard I could try, I cannot get past level 1.
Yeah.
You know, my street cred is on the line here. But these games lived up to that reputation of being some of the hardest ever. And as much as we play games, as much as I play different games, couldn't overcome it. So sadly, I wasn't able to see every aspect of the story as you move through the games. But that was one thing that I saw that was called out was, you know, once you're into it, it's pretty much just game. And then
You're just rolling.
That's it.
Well, and you have no idea why you're doing any of it. I guess that's my biggest problem with it all. Like,
exactly.
And even to some extent, Super Ghouls and Ghosts, while it does have a much better opening cinematic, it doesn't improve on that. Like, when I moved, I did the same thing with Super Ghouls and Ghosts. I got to the finale of stage 1 and I beat it, and I moved on to stage 2. There was no cutscene. There was still no explanation on why things were happening.
Zero reward for doing this amazing feat of just getting to level 2.
Yeah, right? And then so let's talk about zero reward. I've read, of course, we never got there. We never beat all 6 levels. But I actually had read that for the NES version, you play all the way through it, you beat it, you don't even get to see the ending credits. It starts you back over at the beginning on a harder difficulty. And then you have to beat that to get an actual ending.
The first beat is not the end.
Yeah.
It's kind of just the beginning. And so that kind of blows my mind. There are some videos out there on YouTube of some people that have blown us out of the water. And, you know, you can see them go start to finish. And it's really impressive.
Yeah.
I mean, if you go and watch those guys and then see it when it comes back on the harder difficulty, I can't even imagine how much they had to have played this game to even get good enough to get to that point. So right. Bravo. I tip my cap to you, sir. But yeah, that was kind of the unfortunate part, was it really made you dig to find out the details about what is actually going on here. And so for me, I'll just cover kind of in one easy swoop here. But I had, because they were so similar between the two.
Yeah.
I had rated both of them at a half star for story.
Okay. Okay.
I like the Arthur aspect, right? Who doesn't like King Arthur?
Yeah.
The demonology aspect was pretty sweet. Really kind of makes me want like a truly like modern game, like an open world, you know, where you play as Arthur and go take out demons and stuff. Because like,
would be cool.
I think that's a cool mashup. But because it doesn't really give it to you, it doesn't give you anything to really chew on as you're playing, I gave it the half star.
That makes sense. That makes sense. For me, I did a half star on Ghosts and Goblins because I figured it's in the booklet. I don't have the booklet, but I'm going to assume that it's in the booklet. Also, it was made in 1985, so it gets a bit of a pass comparing it to other games at the time. For Super Ghouls and Ghosts, it gets another goose egg.
Oh.
And I'm giving it a goose egg because compared to other games at the time, which I did this for NES in 1985, I'm going to do it here for the SNES. In 1991, we had Super Mario World was out. Final Fantasy V was out. The Legend of Zelda: A Link to the Past was out.
Okay.
Super Castlevania IV was out. So there's these games that are out there that prove that you can tell a story and have good gameplay. So it might get a pass because of the simplicity of the gaming experience. When you compare it to other games at the time, they should have done a lot more.
That's super fair. I'm really glad you brought that up because I did not go outside the box on that.
Yeah.
I was definitely super focused solely on this, and I didn't really think about how exactly did it line up to others. I mean, most people historically revere these games as being, you know, some of the best on these consoles. Like we said in the intro, Super Ghouls and Ghosts was even ranked, you know, a top 25 game on console at that time in the late 90s. But if you do compare those just straight up apples to apples to some of those other games that you mentioned,
yeah,
there is a lot more value coming back to you as a player because you're getting invested in these characters. You're learning about the lore and the mythology of what's going on and things like that. So that is very, very fair.
Yeah, and so the last one, the other 1991 game that you and I both love, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Turtles in Time.
Ooh, Turtles in Time. It did have cutscenes. It did have some dialogue in it. So.
Yes, it did, yeah. And yeah. Even if it's just words on the screen, you got to give me something.
That's true.
And so that's why it gets it's harsh. I know I'm being harsh, but...
Super fair, though.
Yeah, I got to give it zero when, like, really looking at it. And maybe if it were 1991, our rating system would be different and it would be adjusted for the time.
Yeah.
But, you know...
Looking at it today.
Looking at today and what our five categories are, it cannot get a point for story out of me.
I didn't think we would differ that much on it, but I think you've really made some good points here, giving me more to think about and chew on.
Yeah. When you go back and replay it, you'll kind of start to analyze it. Because like you said, or you know, as I've said this whole time, the game doesn't give you anything. It doesn't cut you any slack. So the least it could do, story-wise, is when you beat a level, give you some sort of reward.
It's
like, nope,
it's
good
all
job.
Stick, no carrot.
It's all, yeah, right? It's all stick, no carrot. That is exactly what it is. It's like, oh, you beat level one, good for you. Here's level two.
Yeah.
Like,
that's funny.
Not even going to progress the story, why the settings have changed. They give you the pan over and show you the different levels and stages that you're going to go to, but... They never actually explained, okay, so we go from a graveyard to a sea level. Well, why? Like, is it because Satan, the demon that's kidnapped Princess Prinprin, has an island, like Shang Tsung, like, and you have to go to an island for a Mortal Kombat tournament, and that's why you got to take a boat?
Well, King Arthur, England's an island.
England is an island. Okay, fair enough. Yeah.
So maybe it takes place in England.
Maybe it takes place in England, but wouldn't he already...
Where Camelot is.
Wouldn't he already be on the island if he's in England?
That's a good point.
I don't know.
Who knows? Who knows? Yeah,
he took him to Iceland.
Now we're trying to justify the unjustifiable.
Yeah, there you go.
All right. Well, last category here. Now I'm really interested to see how you rated this, but is our special geek catch-up only category of sauciness. So what did you have Ghosts and Goblins rated in at for sauciness?
Sauciness is a zero.
Ooh.
It's a zero because it's a good retro game, sure, but I'm looking at it through the lens of there's a huge catalog of retro games out there that are now available to us. Am I ever going to choose to go back to this game when I've got Punch-Out, Super Mario, you know, Zelda, all Gradius, Defenders, other NES games that I could go play? Like, am I going to go back to this one? And the answer for me is probably no. I'm not.
I gave it a half star, pretty much still just built around the difficulty. Like, there is a part of me that challenge makes me want to go and just sit down and play it another 10, 20 hours so that way I could say that I got through four levels or that I got to the end and I actually somehow, some way beat it.
Yeah.
You know, and just put that on the video game resume. But also very similar to you, I don't think that that's going to happen with the NES game because of the fact that there are such better games on that console that I would probably choose before Ghosts and Goblins.
And ones that are just as difficult.
There are some.
I mean, if we look at Mega Man 1, you know, Mega Man 1, 2, or 3, they're just as hard and they're more satisfying.
That is true. Made by the same guy.
Made by the same guy. Yeah, you know, I pulled Mega Man. They're all fairly difficult, you know. some of them, maybe not so much, Space Invaders and, what, 1985?
Yeah.
You know, those games have difficult spots, but, you know, they're more fun, they're more rewarding, and that's ultimately, you know, I won't beat a dead horse, but that's why my choice was made, is that I'm not going to go back and play it.
True.
But what about Super Ghouls and Ghosts?
So there was a little bit different for me. I gave it a 1-star for sauciness, and even with the challenges that it brought, you know, bringing in better graphics, increased capabilities, more enemies, it has, you know, more of that look of the platformers that I remember from my youth. It really kind of gave me more desire to play. Mm-hmm. I found myself playing it more after getting some time with Ghosts and Goblins. And to be honest, you know, even though it had been 20 years since I'd played this game, I actually do find myself wanting to continue pursuing it
mm-hmm.
more than ever, just because it's refreshed it in my mind. I do think that there's a lot there and that it would be a game that would be more fun to conquer. And then, you know, with the Switch Online multiplayer capabilities and stuff like that, you know, maybe we jump back on one day and we try to tag team it again here and there in the future to see if we can get through it. But I really like Super Ghouls and Ghosts a lot more than Ghosts and Goblins. So if I find myself playing either of these again, it's going to be that one.
I wholeheartedly agree there. Like, if it's one or the other, I'm definitely going to go Super Ghouls and Ghosts. And then for all the reasons you just named, the increased in graphics, sounds, gameplay, like playability, more rewarding. Having gotten to the final boss of the first level, it is pretty sweet. It's like this giant dragon. And for me, it like really invoked Dark Souls feel, where like you go into this gigantic enemy. And while like, no, I've never quite played Dark Souls, I've seen enough streams online to know what those enemy types look like. And I think knowing that you like those type of games, once you get to that point, you're really going to be like, okay, it's really a 1991 version of this super hard game that I play now.
Yeah. And I think that was really what attracts me and draws me to it. It was frustrating.
Yeah.
I've not had any game, even Dark Souls. I beat Dark Souls. I beat Dark Souls 2. I beat Dark Souls 3 like 7 times over with New Game Plus. None of those games have whooped me up and down the way Ghosts and Goblins and Super Ghouls and Ghosts did. I'll totally admit it.
Yeah.
But it was fun, and I'm really glad that we went back and looked at them, because, you know, they've been kind of on my shelf calling my name for a long time because of all the everything that's built up around them and the way people talk about them today.
Yeah.
And so getting back and really seeing them live up to that legacy.
Yeah.
I really actually enjoyed in its own way.
Yeah. And I can agree with that. I'll say in the end, my final rating for Super Ghouls and Ghosts, as far as sauciness, it also got a 0.
Wow.
And it's really, I think I would, after having this conversation, I would consider maybe giving it a 0.5-star, because you're right. Like, it did a lot of things and I enjoyed it more than I thought I did. You know, I wouldn't have put as many hours into this as I had.
Sure.
If I didn't enjoy it on some level. So maybe it deserves a 0.5-star. But again, with the same lens as the NES version, when I look at the back catalog of available games to me, and even games in the same genre, I don't think I'm going to go to Super Ghouls and Ghosts. I think I would be more inclined to play like a Joe and Mac.
Yeah.
I think I'd be more inclined to play a different side-scrolling platformer.
Well, let's take it home then here. What did we have as our final ratings for each? So starting with Ghosts and Goblins, I'll kick us off here. I ended up with a 3 out of 5 stars.
3 out of 5 stars. Nice, nice. I ended up with a 1.5.
1.5. I think that is the lowest we've had on our Geek Ketchup ratings so far.
It is. It is. I almost feel guilty. You know, it's one of those things where you're working through and you're giving each individual section a ranking. And then when you have to go to the end and you have to add them up, you're like, oh my God, I gave this game a 1.5. I'm being so hard on this game. But that's the way it goes with these 5 categories and how I've looked at them and how I've approached it. Yeah, 1.5. It's tough.
Yeah, it happens, you know. It's how the cookie crumbles sometimes.
True.
So then what about Super Ghouls and Ghosts?
Super Ghouls and Ghosts is a little more generous, and that one ended up with 2.5.
All right.
So 2.5, which isn't, it still doesn't sound great, but I think if you factor in, like, with a little more debate, I might be willing to give it a half star somewhere, whether it be technical performance or sauciness, which would bump it up to a 3, which would make it more respectable. But I'm sticking to my guns, and it's not going to get that half star out of me, so it sits at a 2.5. How about you?
Yeah, I feel like I was almost overgenerous, but I actually, like I said, I enjoyed most of Super Ghouls and Ghosts and everything that it brought to the table, and so it ended up at a 4.5 out of 5 stars.
Wow.
I know, right? I'm looking at it now kind of in the opposite of what you just said, because you brought such good points that maybe I was a little easy on or was overlooking, didn't catch my attention as much. But I thought all in all, I enjoyed it. I definitely wouldn't put it into the top tier of my favorite SNES games of all time, but it's on my radar a lot more now, and so, you know, I was pretty generous to it.
yeah, and really looking at it, you know, Desert Island games, even if you gave me 10 or 15 Desert Island games for just the SNES, I'm not sure I would take it, you know, and I don't, it's just tough, and ultimately, as much as I want to give it some points in certain areas, you made good points, and that's kind of why we do these. We look at them differently in different lenses, and talk about it. It's like, oh, you're right, I didn't think of it that way.
Exactly.
Like, and so maybe I should have been a little more generous. Historically, I am a little more generous to games, but for this one, couldn't do it. So while both of these titles are by all means classics in the hearts of many retro gaming fans, we can't say that either one of us fell in love with them or would be likely to return to getting our butts kicked by the hordes of zombies anytime soon. Hit us up on social media and let us know what you think, whether you've got a secret trick that helps, or if you're like us and you struggle to get past stage 1. We'd love to hear from you, and remember to catch us for our final chapter of season 1 coming later this month.
Thank you for listening to Geek Ketchup. If you enjoyed today's chapter, please remember to subscribe to Geek Ketchup on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Check out Geek Ketchup on Facebook and YouTube. And follow us on Twitter and Instagram at GeekCatchUpPod for updates on new episodes every 2 weeks. You can find links to all these accounts in the show notes below or at our website, www.geekketchuppodcast.com. Stay saucy, you nerds.